Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll talk more about sequestration and the president's budget with former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Wiener, Common Cause president and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar, and AFGE public policy director Jackie Simon. And later, we'll discuss AFGE's contract agreement with the Small Business Administration with Council 228 President Elaine Powell Belnavis. Up first, former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Wiener. Bob, great to have you back on the show.
It's a pleasure, Jason, and boy, do you get the issues that matter to everybody.
Bob, sequestration still looms large in Washington. You, along with Dr. Patricia Berg, penned an op-ed recently discussing sequestration's impact on cancer research. Tell me about this.
Well, let's disclose that Dr. Patricia Berg is my wife, who is a major national cancer researcher in breast cancer, and the two of us attended the American Association for Cancer Research annual convention, where 18,000 scientists gathered, and they not only gathered to discuss their research, but they held a rally for medical research. These wonky researchers, nothing against Pat, she is a beautiful, great, you know, vivacious woman, but these wonky researchers poring over their microscopes in the library grounds, and then in rhythm to drumbeats, yelling, more progress, more hope, more life, led by Cokie Roberts, herself a cancer survivor. The problem is that they, in sequestering cancer, they are threatening the 30% increase in life, the reduction in mortality, 30% reduction in mortality that's occurred in the last three decades because of cancer research. 40,000 women a year die from breast cancer research alone. 1.6 million people a year get it. And one out of two men and one out of three women get cancer sometime in their lives. So the research that has helped in reduction of mortality by a third over the last three decades is just critical. And the research, the treatments, the prevention strategies, the knowledge. So we're cutting off our nose to spite our face. And, Jason, we are taking away the leadership in the world that we have so that people will go to China where they don't have sequestration, for example. There were 75 countries that came to this national convention because the USA is the leader with a $750 billion budget at the NIH. So if you have that and you're reducing it and China isn't reducing the budget, where do you think the researchers are going to go? So even Republicans and Democrats alike, the cancer isn't Democrat or Republican. John Porter, who served for 21 years in the Congress, a leader in appropriation and is now chair of Research America, said, "We played nice, so it's time to get mad, to get militantly moderate."
Bob, speaking of that NIH budget, you wrote that NIH has lost 20% in real dollars after inflation over the past decade. Expand upon that and talk to me about the subsequent impact.
Well, it means grants are frozen. It means that you're cutting off future research. You're stopping research dead in its tracks so that there are no additional advances that can be made by scientists who are on the cutting edge. So as I said, we're cutting off our nose to spite our face, as Pat and I said in the Washington Times op-ed, and I hope that all of our readers can go to it, either to the Washington Times website or my own, wienerpublic.com, where we also have it, or Truthout, which printed it out and sent it to all their readers, 250,000 additional readers, and it's really tracked all over the country. But this is a disaster to cut off this research and to freeze it more in addition to the cuts that have been made, as you said, 20% cut because when you don't include inflation and you just freeze the budget, you're actually doing a 20% cut over the decade. And the rally, Jason, wasn't limited to cancer. You had people with HIV, diabetes, heart attack, stroke. You had an Alzheimer's caregiver. These people are all survivors, they said, because of medical research. And sequestration isn't just on health care. It's stopping children from preschool. It's blocking our roads and bridges from repairs. It's cutting nutrition programs. But I do think that the clearest indication of the stupidity of Washington's gridlock in this case and ineptness is the reports that Medicare cancer clinics are having to turn away a third of their patients from chemotherapy, literally sentencing them to death. So, yep.
Bob, so that's already happening right now, this byproduct of sequestration with people at Medicare cancer clinics needing chemotherapy?
Yes, that's been in the press, that cancer clinics are turning away a third of their patients from chemotherapy. And, you know, Democrats are convinced that because of sequestration, defense cuts can't happen, and Republicans did sequestration and they're maintaining it because social program cuts won't occur any other way without the bludgeon of the sequester. Well, okay, Jason, the bludgeon has happened. So now maybe both sides can rationally act and come up with a progressive budget that actually helps people. But it can't be. You know, I love President Obama. I'm a team player with President Obama. But his reducing Social Security benefit cost of living is to me, inexcusable. And Social Security is actually funded by seniors' premiums for the next 30 years. Shouldn't be on the backs of seniors. It should be on the wars. It should be going back to the Clinton tax breaks. We should be creating jobs, which are, by all accounts of economists, the way to jack up the economy are with jobs, instead of continuing the tax breaks where ExxonMobil and GE are paying zero in taxes. I mean, that's just outrageous. That's why President Obama has said that without doing a balanced approach and doing the tax reform that's necessary, he will not. He's actually backed off a little now and said do the Social Security cuts. But I was concerned about that. As you know, I asked a question in the White House news conference where the president released the budget and raised that issue.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Bob Wiener, former Clinton White House spokesman. Bob, let's talk about the larger issue here of sequestration, where we're seeing cuts that are broad-based and not targeted, and the impact of things like what you've been talking about, medical research, specifically cancer research.
Well, it's really a disaster. I mean, I used to tell people, Jason, that I'm going to be old someday. When I was the chief of staff of the House Aging Committee, and I was 28, and I was the youngest chief of staff of any committee in Congress, because Claude Pepper wanted to show that there is no such thing as ageism in any direction. But now I am old. I'm 66. So I have an even greater concern for the issues that affect the elderly and health care than I used to, perhaps. And so it is just an outrage to tell seniors that you're going to have less money and you're going to, because of sequestration, and you've got to get the money if you're going to do it from places that shouldn't happen, Jason. You know, right after the president released the budget last week, he had a news conference, and I was there. I was at the Rose Garden with the president at the announcement, and I was at the news conference where Gene Sperling, the president's chief economic advisor, and Jeff Sion from OMB, and Cecilia Munoz from the Domestic Policy Council, and the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, Alan Krueger, were answering questions to follow up on the president's budget, where he wants to cut another $2.5 trillion and do it in a rational way, unlike the Republicans who are trying to just do it against all the social programs. But the president includes these cuts to Social Security and Medicare. So I asked them a question. Why are they doing cuts to Social Security and Medicare to appease Boehner, when those will just increase poverty among the elderly, which has dropped because of Social Security and Medicare from 65% to 7%. And then if you means test, which is one of their proposals, don't you crumble overall support for the programs, Medicare and Social Security, which was Claude Pepper's argument as to why there was no means testing in the programs. The transcript of the responses that they gave, Jason, the four of them looked at each other, and finally their eyes stared at Gene Sperling, because he's the guy who knows how to play the politics the best. But the transcript of the responses from him and Jay Carney was almost funny, if the outcome weren't so dangerous, about how, well, no one will really lose, and if you means test, we're still going to make sure that even the people who have the most income still get something out of it. I mean, that they've paid for this. Their insurance policies have paid for the program, and it's solvent for 30 years. That's the way it was designed in 1983 when they made the last compromise. So here they are. They're going to chip away again. I remember when Claude Pepper held his nose at the 65 to 67-year age increase compromise that was done for Social Security. And he said, no, 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 no. And then everybody persuaded him that it was going to be even worse if he didn't agree to it. And finally, okay, agreed to it, but only on the condition that the program were solvent for 75 years, which, by the way, we're only 30 years into. and it is solvent for about that 75 years. And even if we get to the end point of that 75 years, one-third of the tax cuts that Bush did, or one-third of the cost of the Iraq war, pick either one, it's a tiny amount of money, will keep Social Security solvent, even in the worst-case scenario, if the economy doesn't improve and we don't drop our jobless rate down even further back to the 3-4% that we'd like. So what's happening is the federal budget, the federal policymakers are trying to steal Social Security money and Medicare money, because 9 years of solvency was added to Medicare through the Obama health care bill, trying to steal Social Security and Medicare money and use it for the rich corporate tax breaks. That's the real deal of what's happening.
Bob, you mentioned there in pretty good detail about how much people are going to lose based on this budget, and federal employees are right in there with them. You yourself served as a federal employee for a
yes.
number of years. What do you make of the increased pension contributions that federal employees are going to have to make, in addition to, of course, we're looking at, in the midst of a 3-year pay freeze, looking at furloughs for federal employees, the list goes on and on. What's your analysis of that?
You know, I was one who believed that they actually wouldn't furlough, because I was part of the double shutdown that we had in Clinton when Gingrich and Clinton were playing effectively the same game, and Gingrich shut down the government. So I didn't think it would happen. I thought they retroactively would just correct all this. It isn't happening. There are actually furloughs all over the place in agency after agency, and they've maintained the freeze so that federal pensioners are not getting cost of living increases. It's in the law that we get shafted, unlike others who at least get a little something in cost of living increases. So there is gross discrimination against federal employees. Jason, you know my position on this, and I want our listeners to know my position on this. You don't make more money as a federal employee than you do in the private sector. You make far, far less, but you've devoted your life to government and public service because you want to do something for your country. That's the reason you're in federal service. And I could have made a ton more money, as my brother did, in the private sector, but I chose not to for the 22 years that I was in federal service. And I chose not to because it really meant something to me to be able to abolish mandatory retirement, to put a spotlight on fraud and abuse in some defense contracting and those kinds of things, and to expand drug policy so that treatment is provided and drug courts are provided, and that we actually did something in foreign policy on drug policy and got Colombia to cut its cocaine by half. Those are things that mean something to the country, to the world, and there's things that I take deep pride in, especially working with Claude Pepper. If you're going to pick one thing, to abolish mandatory retirement so that it's based on skill, not age. And we brought in Colonel Sanders and Will Geer and Avril Harriman. You know, and lobbyists would come in, and they'd even try to pay my lunch to try to get this exception and that exception, and I would insist on paying my own lunch. I'd listen to anybody, but I wouldn't take a dime of any kind of money that I thought was tainted elsewise. And I didn't care that in those days I was making 50, which is a nice salary. I mean, it's probably the equivalent of 100 now, and then by the time I left the White House, I was making 108. But in the private sector, if I were doing national public affairs and media and legislative strategy, you know, I'd be in the 500,000 range. But I chose public service because I wanted to make a difference. Money was not what drove me. Mission was. And I think that's true for virtually every public servant, except for a couple of slimy ones, including a couple slimy members of Congress. But I think virtually everyone, 98 to 99% of them, are in it because of the mission of helping people. So to use them as foils and pawns and to take away money from them when that's what they need to feed their families, I think is an outrage. And people should understand the real gift that public servants provide for this country.
Bob Wiener, the former Clinton White House spokesman. Bob, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks so much, Jason. A pleasure being with you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by AFGE Council 228 President Elaine Powell Belnavis to discuss the union's labor contract with the Small Business Administration.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasing power.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by Elaine Powell-Belnavis, the president of AFGE's Small Business Administration Council 228. Elaine, first time on the program. Welcome.
Thank you.
Elaine, we're proud to announce here that AFGE and the Small Business Administration earlier this year reached agreement on a new labor contract covering more than 2,000 federal employees. Before we get into the specifics of the contract agreement, what does it mean to you personally to have come to this agreement?
Well, it was a lot of hard work, and I think that now that this agreement has come to closure, we can move forward with getting the employees all of the benefits that AFG Council 228 has gotten them in this particular contract. We were operating from an old contract that was 1999 contract. So this new contract has given new life to the union as well as the agency.
Talk to me a little bit about some of that work that went into getting this contract done.
Well, it turned out to be a lot of work because of the fact that we went through a couple of administrations. We was in the Bush administration and we was in the Obama administration. But ultimately, we've come to an agreement and we are ready to move forward with this contract. There's a lot of excitement here at the agency with regard to this new contract that we have here, both for the employees and for management.
Elaine, what does it mean for morale to have a new contract, to, as the saying goes, out with the old, in with the new? What does that mean for employees?
Well, this new contract brought about a lot of new things and for employees, a bunch of benefits that were not previously available to them. One being a new flexible schedule, which is a 10-hour day. That's a schedule that we did not have before. And now we do have that. And we tried to close a lot of the loopholes in this new contract that was open in the old contract. Some of the problems, basically, that we were encountering in the 1999 contract, we tried to streamline that and make it a lot easier or better for the employees in 2013 contract.
I think you bring up a great point there. Things change from year to year and from decade to decade. And from 1999 to now in 2013, certainly things have changed in the workplace, in the world around us. One of those things, of course, is that flexible work schedule that people like to have that helps them manage their lives in its entirety and also be able to get their job done to the best of their abilities. Is that one of those things that you see almost as a game changer for employees?
Oh, definitely, definitely. The 410 schedule was definitely a game changer. In addition to that, Jason, they had a situation where we were teleworking in the old contract, and there was all kinds of problems with the telework process. And then the new contract, we streamlined that process so that we could make it easier. In addition to that, you know, the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, also had rules and regulations that also makes it easier for employees to telework as opposed to how it was going down in 1999, back in that and during that period of time. So now we have the 410 schedule, and we also have telework, in which both of those things was a boost to the employees. It's almost like a shot in the arm for the employees here at the SBA. So everybody's excited about that.
Talk to me about how it relates specifically to SBA, the concept of telework and it allowing employees to move the business of the agency forward under any circumstances.
Well, what happens with the flexible, with the telework, people are allowed to work at home so they can get more done, so they don't have to be doing all of this traveling. I know in New York, where I'm located at, a lot of times we have to take trains to get to work and buses to get to work. So some people are taking trains and buses. That energy that one was exuding to get to work can be put to work by not basically moving from the household or from a telework center, but going straight there and then you have more energy to get what you have to get done. So I think that the fact that people are allowed to telework gives them a lot of things to look forward to in terms of those people being able to get the job done during the day.
Elaine, you also negotiated an awards program for employees at SBA. Tell me about that.
Well, what we were finding out is that here at the SBA, people felt that they were underappreciated. In other words, you was asking for more of them, but they wasn't receiving from you what they felt that they should be receiving. So we went back to some old things that we had been doing before, which was recognizing employees who had been here for like 5 years. We were not even getting an appreciation, the pen and the certificate for the 5 years that you had been here. In addition, we did not issue letters of appreciation to employees who did a good job, letters of commendation. Some of the supervisors had indicated to us that money was an issue, so they were unable to issue awards that had money attached to them. So we went back to say, you know, a certificate of appreciation, a certificate of accommodation would at least let the manager know, let the employee know that the manager appreciated them and the work that they were doing. So we went back to some of those things that they were doing a long, long time ago so that employees would know that that their work was appreciated by the SBA.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Elaine Powell-Belnavis, the president of AFGE's Small Business Administration Council 228. Elaine, on the issue of the awards program, we've covered some of these contract negotiations on Inside Government here in the past, and the presence of an awards program is significant for employees, and I'm getting the sense that it has to do greatly with the amount of pride that AFGE members, that federal employees take in their work, especially because they're mission-driven being public employees. Are you finding that in your agency as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. People are very committed here at the SBA. The employees are, because our work directly affects the economy in that we are providing a good or a service for small businesses. And employees take a lot of pride in that. They understand that, you know, with all these budget cuts, that management might not be able to give them a financial award. But at the same time, that's no reason why you can't give someone a non-monetary award. So from that perspective, we felt that they should at least say, we appreciate the work that you do for the small business community, and that the manager was recognizing the employees for doing that, going above and beyond to get that particular thing done. There was also, Jason, another program called a Star Award program, which was a program where you get days off based on a performance of a particular job that you would do. And what ended up happening is that I felt that this program was underutilized. In this new contract, it is another avenue that we go to so that employees can be shown that they are appreciated. It's not direct money, but it's indirect money for a job well done.
And I think you make a great point about something as simple as a certificate and a pin for an employee who may have been there for a certain amount of time, because it's the recognition that matters. Federal employees know that they're not necessarily going to make millions of dollars in federal service, but it certainly helps to show them that what they're doing is appreciated by management and the public at large, right?
Absolutely. These employees take their job very serious here at SBA because they know that what they do is important, not just for the agency, but for the communities all across the United States of America that we're entrusted with representing, and making sure that the small business person have what they need to get those businesses up and running, because, of course, they are successful. They are hiring more employees, which helps the economy at large there. So they understand all of that. But no one wants to go and do a job and not be appreciated for that job. So I think the little things go a long way when you can say to someone, we really do appreciate. I don't have anything, you know, monetary to give you, but I wanted to give you this certificate. I wanted to give you this plaque to let you know that I do appreciate what you do.
You also negotiated an expedited arbitration process. What can you tell me about that?
Well, with the expedited arbitration process, we would have took specific cases, and performance was one of them, where an employee would work the whole year round, and then they would find out that the employee and the supervisor was on two different pages. The supervisor didn't think the employee did a great job, and the employee him or herself thought that they did. Instead of going through the entire grievance process, which is somewhat lengthy, we decided to go through an expedited arbitration process and kind of cut the time in half and kind of go right into arbitration and get this resolved, because to have an issue hanging out there so long between an employee and a supervisor, it just doesn't pay. We wanted to bring closure to that issue so that the parties could get together and move on.
And lastly, there's also an expansion of transit subsidies. Tell me about that and the impact it's going to have for all federal employees who are commuting into the office every day.
Well, that's a good thing for all of those areas that have mass transit systems. We have included the entire agency in this transit thing. Before that, Jason, we didn't have this in the contract. We had come to somewhat of an agreement, but it was a memorandum of understanding outside the contract. When we negotiated this contract, it became a part of the contract. And something being outside the contract and something being in the contract are two different things. This was something that was initiated by me when they had approved transit subsidies. I asked the agency to negotiate transit subsidies, and at first they did not want to do it. And then we filed a charge with the Federal Labor Relations Authority, and the authority had ruled that the union, in addition to management, can ask to negotiate something. Basically, unions operate where management comes to them and say, this is what we want to negotiate. Rarely do the union go to management and say, this is what we want to negotiate. So I approached them with this transit subsidy and said that AFGE Council 228 would like to negotiate transit subsidies. They didn't approach me to ask me to do that. We approached them.
Elaine, separately from the contract, you are looking at another issue with management around some employees being left out of a settlement there at the agency. What can you tell me about that?
Well, that's an ongoing thing, and I think that the agency is moving a little slow in the process. But AFG Council 228 back in 2009 won a $7.6 million Fair Labor Standards Act settlement against the SBA. And what ended up happening is some of the employees that should have benefited from the settlement did not, because of what they call a miscoding problem. The miscoding problem is a situation at the SBA where employees was coded outside the bargaining unit when they should have been coded inside the bargaining unit. And that is something that's been going on. I am hearing from the agency that they are going to put teams together to address this issue. But my opinion is this is taking far too long for the agency to address this issue. Employees want the employees that was left out is waiting to get their coding corrected so that they can be a part. And right now, we're not quite sure where this extra money is coming from, Jason, because the $7.6 million have been distributed. The entire amount of money has already been distributed. So we're not quite sure where that money is going to come from. But when we won this case, these employees should have been included in the $7.6 million. They were not. So the union and the agency, once they get this together, we'll have to sit down to decide how are we going to compensate these employees.
Elaine Powell-Belnavis, the president of AFGE's Small Business Administration Council 228. Elaine, great having you on the program for the first time today. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll talk more about the president's budget with Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, SeaWorld, and Universal Studios? And if you enjoy winter activities, take advantage of discount lift tickets for New England ski resorts. These are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. AFGE also offers members a host of other valuable benefits, from scholarships memberships and insurance to discounts on computers, appliances, health clubs, and more. AFGE is the largest and most influential federal and D.C. government employee union in the United States. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Go to AFGE.org and click on the Join AFGE Today button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by former Congressman Bob Edgar, the now President and CEO of Common Cause. Congressman, welcome back.
It's great to be with you today.
Congressman, with President Obama releasing his fiscal 2014 budget proposal last week, I wanted to get your analysis on two key components. First, the chained CPI cost of living calculation, and second, the increase in pension contributions for federal employees.
I think in both issues, the president has probably gone too far. One would hope that the president's budget would be a negotiating point with the conservatives who are going to cut and slash it even further. And the president seems committed to show his bottom line and where he wants to end up. But he has shown that up front rather than using it as a negotiating point. I think in terms of the cost of living increase, that's not what's causing our budget deficits. Our budget deficits are caused by Democrats and Republicans voting for two wars without raising revenues to pay for it. The deficit and the budget trauma that we've been going through, you can't go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan and then give away the store as was done in the former Bush administration. So I would urge the president to rethink both of those issues. We need to protect the rights of our federal employees, and we need to protect the rights of our senior adults. Hubert Humphrey was the one who said, the moral test of government is what we do for those in the dawn of life, our children, and those in the twilight of life, the elderly, and all of those in the shadows of life, the poor, the sick, and the disabled. My 88-year-old mother lives primarily on her Social Security funds. If she didn't have three sons who were supplementing that, she would be in the poorhouse. I think Social Security is a great thing, and the cost of living increment that is provided should stay in place as is.
Congressman, as someone who spent time serving the people, serving in the House of Representatives, how dangerous is it for the president, as you said, to go too far in this budget proposal that takes a look at some of these things like chain CPI and then asks even more out of federal employees?
Well, again, we're trying to fix a fiscal problem that was caused by going to war without paying for it rather than finding alternatives. I would suggest to the president there's lots of money in having a strong practical defense system, but not the overkill. We're still building weapons in the defense area that are exquisitely prepared for World War II and fail to recognize that we need a defense budget that is lean and mean and able to move quickly, and it doesn't need the kind of overkill that we have. And I would find the savings there. When you take $10, $15, $20 billion out of defense that is already overextended, you can curb some of your appetite to balance the budget on the backs of senior citizens and poor people and children.
Can you give me a sense for what happens next in the budget process, where it goes, how likely it is to have changes implemented in it?
I'm going to give you an unusual answer. I think the budget process, unfortunately, and I say the word unfortunately underscored, has been pretty much a game or a myth over the last few years. My hope would be that Democrats and Republicans and independents who serve in the House and Senate would go back to a negotiated agreement between the legislative
bodies and the executive branch and start putting together a budget that was real and not simply a political document. Ever since the rise of the Tea Party and some of the things that have taken place over the last 20 years, this budget process has been somewhat of gamesmanship by both Democrats and Republicans, and it doesn't have the kind of weight and force that one would hope. When the budget process was put in place back, at least in my time of mid to late 70s, the budget chairs of the House and Senate would work with the White House to try to craft a budget that was realistic and responsive to the needs of the nation, as opposed to simply putting them together as a political document. So I guess I don't know what's next other than she said, he said, your position, now my position, and the bottom line is nothing happens.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with former Congressman Bob Edgar, now the president and CEO of Common Cause. Congressman, despite the uncertainty, one of the things that we do know is that Common Cause is working very heavily towards some government reforms and trying to make things more accessible for people and the government to run more efficiently. What are some of the top things that you're working on these days?
Well, we have a federal lawsuit against the United States Senate on the question of the Senate rule called the filibuster. This is a pretty arcane and complicated issue, but over the last 10 years, ultra-conservatives have discovered that if 41 senators want to block something, they force a 60-vote supermajority on every issue. So we went to court. We believe the filibuster is actually unconstitutional. It's not in the Constitution. It was invented by Aaron Burr 20 years after the Constitution, wasn't named a filibuster till 50 years after. Up till 1970, the filibuster was used more often to protect slavery and lynching laws than human rights, civil rights. Even when Jimmy Stewart had the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where he stood on the Senate floor and filibustered an issue, there were zero filibusters that year. Over the last several years, over 100 filibusters per year have been put forward. Even as we're talking today about the gun legislation that's before the Senate leaders, both Democratic and Republican, have done an unfortunate thing, and they've said every amendment has to pass the 60-vote rule. That's simply outrageous, so Common Cause is pushing back there. We're also pushing back on a group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. This is a group of 2,000 state representatives sitting side by side with 150 to 250 corporations, putting forward legislation, model legislation in the states. We saw them last year on the Stand Your Ground law. We saw them trying to prevent people from voting, passing ID legislation state by state. This is a group of education for-profit institutions trying to buy off public education, for-profit prison industry trying to spread for-profit prisons around the country. So Bob Edgar and Common Cause have filed a whistleblower complaint with the IRS because ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, files with the IRS as a charity, much like the Red Cross or the United Way, and yet 75 to 80% of their work is hardcore lobbying. Over the next couple months, when the IRS comes out with its finding, many of the corporations that have stayed with ALEC will be subject to penalties and fines, and ALEC clearly will have to change its IRS status and fully be transparent as a hardcore lobbying operation.
And Congressman, as we close out here, are you fully expecting the IRS to rule in your favor on that?
We're using a pro bono law firm out of San Francisco who specializes in whistleblower complaints. The 4,800 documents that we've submitted, our legal team says it's the strongest whistleblower tax fraud complaint that they filed, and they specialize in it. So we're pretty confident that we're right, that this is a lobbying organization camouflaged and hiding behind charity rules.
Former Congressman Bob Edgar, now the president and CEO of Common Cause. Congressman, it's always fun to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
Great to be with you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn more about proposed changes to the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program with AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program. It offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program's administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office. It's handled more than 700 cases since 2005 and won millions of dollars in back pay for its members. In each of the last 2 years alone, AFGE attorneys have brought in more than $1 million in attorney's fees. Their attorneys are experienced litigators and committed to the best possible representation. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit Systems Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For more information about the program, please call 202-639-6424. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Jackie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie, you testified this week before a House Oversight and Government Reform Subcommittee about the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. What was the focus of your testimony?
Well, OPM has a package of changes they'd like to see enacted. And the hearing was to discuss each of these proposals and what their likely impact would be on the program, on enrollees, on costs.
Let's talk about some of these proposed changes to the program. First and foremost, you discussed discounts for wellness. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, it sounds nice, discounts for wellness, but the flip side, of course, is to charge more for people who have the misfortune of having an illness or having some kind of physical condition over which they have no control, and consequently being charged more than their coworker. And we really look at health insurance as a form of compensation. We wouldn't pay lower salaries to people who happen to be ill for doing the same job. And providing, you know, less of an employer subsidy for health insurance is no different from a lower salary. And one of the things, of course, they're really talking about is obesity. More and more medical research has shown that obesity is as much a function of genetics as height. Although we all know that we should eat a healthy diet and exercise and all that kind of thing, whether or not we are obese is almost apart from what we eat and how much we exercise. And I don't say that. It's not true across the board, but it's true for some people. And there's no reason they should receive lower compensation from their employer just because of a genetic condition.
There was also talk about adding a new premium tier called the Self Plus One. What can you tell me about that?
Well, it's very frustrating. I can only tell you a little. For years and years, OPM's actuaries maintained that Self Plus One would be more expensive than family coverage. Now, OPM says that government would save quite a bit of money by implementing a Self Plus One, but one of the most frustrating things is that OPM has refused to provide us any kind of information, about what kind of models their actuaries use to come up with their estimates of the impact of Self Plus One. So the short answer is that we have absolutely no idea what it would do to premiums, what it would do if people migrated out of family coverage into Self Plus One, or would they go to a completely different plan. It would have multiple consequences for the program. And, OPM's favorite line is there'll be winners and losers. Well, we want to know who's winning, who's losing, how much are they winning by, how much are the losers losing by, what's the overall cost, and what would be the impact on premiums for family and for Self Plus One. We haven't had any of those questions answered.
You mentioned that OPM was not very forthcoming with some information. Why is that?
It's truly bizarre, and all I can do is speculate about the motivations of some of the people who are working over at OPM. It's ironic. There was more transparency and more access in the George W. Bush administration than there's been in this administration at OPM, that is. And I hasten to add, only in the area of healthcare. Obviously, the other staff at OPM are great, and they're always very helpful and open and provide information on, you know, retirement and pay and things like that, but not on health insurance. Very secretive, and it's very frustrating. That's why we also call in our testimony for the establishment of an employee advisory council on FEHBP, similar to what we have on the Thrift Savings Plan, on white and blue collar pay, where we have by law the right to sit down with OPM and receive information and have input into the administration of the program.
One of the other things that you mentioned in your testimony were the regional PPOs proposal. Tell me about those.
Well, that's another proposal about which OPM refuses to provide any information. Their target really is Blue Cross Blue Shield. What they want to do is eliminate the national plan because, of course, Blue Cross Blue Shield has a national plan for the federal government, but there's also a Blue Cross Blue Shield organization in every state, and the national plan wouldn't compete with these regional PPOs. And there's a big question about whether or not, what would be the benefit of a regional PPO? It'd be smaller than Blue Cross Blue Shield national, so it would have less market power and have less ability to control prices. We're not sure at all that it would be a better deal. But again, it's one of those winners and losers kind of things. I think, in theory, prices might be cheaper in a couple of states and much, much higher in other states. And, we'd be open to hearing more about it if OPM would provide some information that they may have, or may not. I'm told they do have, they just won't provide it, that would tell us, who would be the losers, who would be the winners. You can't really take a position in favor of something like that without information about what its impact would be. And having no information in our testimony, we oppose that change.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Jackie, how much of the total premiums do federal employees and retirees pay?
Well, it varies, but on average, in the aggregate for the whole program, employees pay about 30% of premiums.
30%. So why is it then that they don't have more say collectively in the decisions that are made related to their health care?
Good question. That's the question we asked the subcommittee, and that's the question we're going to be asking all lawmakers to answer with the establishment of an advisory committee so we can have some formal input.
Another issue that's getting a lot of attention is the coverage of the applied behavioral analysis therapy for autism. Talk about why this is so important to federal employees.
Well, I believe 37 states right now, and counting, because there are more all the time, mandate coverage for ABA for children with severe autism. Obviously not everybody on the autism spectrum requires this form of treatment, but those who do require it, it's life-saving, it's life-altering, it's widely recognized as the most effective therapy, and it's crucial that it be available to these children when they're very young. And FEHBP, OPM has for years, I've been working on this issue for years and years, they've said, oh, it's a form of education, it's occupational therapy, it's not health care. When 37 states recognize it as health care, the federal government just sort of stands alone and looks foolish. This is, really almost, it's not life and death in the sense of cancer treatment or no cancer treatment, but it's so, so life-altering for people who receive this kind of therapy. It can really make the difference between having any kind of ability to function independently or being dependent all your life. So it's cost-effective for the government, and it's certainly the humane thing to do. John Barry, on his, in his better moments, recognized that this was desirable, and he was very proud of the fact that he made it optional in OPM rather than prohibiting it. But very, very few plans responded to the option. And Blue Cross Blue Shield, of course, the big one, covers 62% of all enrollees, does not provide coverage. So we want it mandated.
Where does OPM stand on domestic partner benefits in the program?
Their initiative is to allow coverage for domestic partners of either same sex or opposite sex couples and their dependents. And, of course, because of DOMA, there's still tax implications. limitations for dependents who don't meet the IRS definition of an economic dependent. So it's still not equal, and although we, you know, support the baby step that OPM is proposing, what we want, of course, is full equality for all federal employees, heterosexual, gay, lesbian, and their families.
How does the Affordable Care Act, or of course Obamacare, factor into all of this?
The biggest thing that we talked about in the testimony is the fact that in 2018, there's this time bomb tax increase that will be passed on to federal employees because federal employee health insurance benefits are very, very expensive. And they're not expensive because they're Cadillac plans and have really rich benefits. They're expensive because of structural flaws in the system. And in spite of the fact that this is a tax supposedly meant to penalize employers or for providing Cadillac plans, what it's really going to do is penalize federal employees because FEHBP is such a poorly run and poorly structured plan.
Jackie, this week President Obama released his fiscal 2014 budget proposal, which included about $35 billion in reforms to the federal retirement programs. Talk to me about this situation and what it actually means for federal employees.
Yeah, I was with President Cox when we got that news, and we were all dumbfounded. We were certainly not just led to believe, told quite explicitly that when Congress enacted and the president signed into law the enormous increase in retirement costs for employees hired after January 1st, 2013, that would be it. That would satisfy Obama's and the Republicans' demand that federal employees pay more for their retirement benefits. So federal employees hired after January 1st, 2013 are going to pay 3.1% of their salaries. It's a 2.3% salary cut forever, supposedly, to respond to a temporary deficit. And now he comes back with another $35 billion in cuts. It's utterly outrageous. It's a total betrayal. It's totally reneging on every understanding that we had made our sacrifice and then some to the federal budget. And this, after 3 years of pay freeze and furloughs from sequestration, it's just such an outrage. We will fight this with everything we've got. I mean, people are angry. They're not disappointed. They're not sad. They're quite angry at this betrayal.
And these are items that are starting to add up. Salary freezes, sequestration, furloughs, increased pension contributions. There's a lot here, totaling, of course, over $100 billion already. What's the outlook on this?
I can't speculate as to when or if it will ever stop, but the only thing standing between this and dramatically lower living standards for federal employees is the effort of AFGE and its members. I know I'll do everything I can. I know our elected leaders will do everything we can, and we just have to try to motivate our members to mobilize against this and really, really let the Congress know that this is utterly unacceptable. You know, Obama may continue in his favorite activity of trying to appease his enemies by going after us. Not that it ever works, but somehow we still get the cuts. But we need to fight this.
And I think it's important to note, and something that you and I have talked about on this program, is that the federal employees that we're talking about here are middle-class Americans.
Absolutely. It was rather galling yesterday to hear that President Obama had said that he promised to protect the middle class in his so-called balanced approach. Well, his balanced approach takes $35 billion out of the pockets of middle class federal employees and their families. And we haven't mentioned the CPI change for Social Security, which will take money out of middle class pockets of people who receive veterans benefits, who've been injured in the course of defending their country through the military, people on disability, retirees in Social Security, and federal retirees. So how dare he present himself as a protector of the middle class when he is simultaneously supporting this outrageous cut in benefits? It's just, well, you can hear the anger in my voice.
Do you imagine a scenario where AFGE will be able to sit down with the administration at some point and perhaps address these issues directly?
I think we will certainly try to do that. And I know that our lobbyists are already on Capitol Hill talking to lawmakers, urging them to reject this budget just in its entirety.
Jackie Simon, AFGE Public Policy Director. Jackie, great having you on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guest this week, former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Weiner, AFGE Small Business Administration Council 228 President Elaine Powell Belnavis, Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar, and AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife.